This is the longest counterinsurgency involvement of the United States since Vietnam. And the majority of people here don't realize how deeply the United States is involved and how directly responsible for this tragedy.
Mm. And that's exactly what we are suggesting to the United States government, that they should find a more constructive policy towards the problems of Latin America. Don't see those problems as a way of communist expansionism, because that's an ideological point of view and close possibilities for understandings.
The press always presents, they say, in the civil war in El Salvador, which has cost 70,000 lives, that, and right away they add, increased violence from both the right and the left. So yeah. The implication is that the left has killed 35,000 and the right has killed 35,000. That's very beautiful. Again, very neat. These people should be given the Pulitzer Prize for misinformation.
We think that the best interest for the United States in Central America is to have peace and social stability instead of war. And at this time, the United States is suggesting just war.
You rarely, if ever, see anything on the regular media, anything from the point of view of the rebels in El Salvador. But that's exactly what you're going to see right now on Alternative Views. Our guests on Alternative Views are both from the rebel side in El Salvador, and they have a point of view which you don't see on the regular media. Arnoldo Ramos is the representative in the United States for the FMLN, the Liberation Front of the Rebels, and Gustavo Acosta is making a tour of the United States and part of the political efforts of the FMLN and the FDR. Our interview with Arnoldo Ramos was held before the Salvadoran elections in February of 89. Our interview with Gustavo Acosta was in May of 1989, after the elections.
There are so many things that are happening. First of all, can you just very briefly tick off just a few things that are happening, and then we'll go more into detail into it?
Well, I think on the military arena, there has been an unprecedented offensive by the FMLN, which in 1985 was present in 5 of the 13 provinces of the country. Today it is present in all the provinces of the country, and fighting is taking place in the major cities, including the capital city, mm-hmm. San Salvador. The military have failed to defend their principal garrisons inside and outside the capital. They have failed to protect the roads. They have failed to protect the economic infrastructure of the country. The war is now permeates and guides our society completely. It's a reality of war. On the other hand, politically, the return of the Democratic Revolutionary Front, the political allies of the guerrillas of the FMLN to San Salvador in the middle of last year, the decision to participate in elections despite the limitations of the electoral system, whereby they have to campaign with bulletproof vests, despite the fact that they don't have any money, despite the fact that they cannot organize or campaign outside the capital city because of the danger of being assassinated, they have become in the last 4 months the third political force in the country. So they have opened a political space where there was no room before. The intention after the March legislative assembly elections that were won by ARENA, defeating the Christian Democrats supported by the United States. After that situation, both the United States and arena, and all the political parties wanted a party of the left to participate in elections to legitimate those elections. And they wanted a type of a left that was like a bonsai left, according to the words of Rubén Zamora. Very tiny, very beautiful, but it doesn't grow.
So basically, the FMLN has been involved in armed resistance for the last 10 years. But in the beginning of the year, you agreed to put down the weapons and to engage in the democratic process if the governing parties would postpone the election from March to September. And the government rejected this offer. They rejected a democratic, peaceful solution, a diplomatic solution to the problems in El Salvador. And you, on April the 6th, returned to make the offer again, that you would still be willing to put down your arms and engage in the democratic process if the government would recognize you as a political force and would stop the repression. What are the conditions that you laid down that would work towards a diplomatic solution?
Okay, I think that the rejections of that proposal is based on the fact that ARENA, for nature, is a repressive party. They represent the interests of a minority, and that is the oligarchy. The oligarchy is not interested in sharing their wealth, you know, with the majority of the population. The oligarchy also understands that Salvadoran armed forces are there to protect their interest, and they think that the armed forces should repress, should make disappear all opposition forces in El Salvador. So that's their nature. They understood, and they said, and they understood that if that proposal of the FMLN was to be implemented, it would be the FMLN and the opposition forces the ones that will be victorious.
Because they have the popular support.
Exactly. Then, but that was attractive for anybody, no? Then the oligarchy and the United States might think, well, what the FMLN will give back, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
if we accept that they will participate, and all, even though they don't have the right to condition our participation,
right.
because we exist whether they like it or not.
Right.
And then we said, well, if we go to elections, to free elections, honest elections, clean elections, and it is shown clearly that we don't have popular support, then we don't have political reasons why to continue the armed struggle.
Mm. Right.
And then we said, so, you know, we will have no political reasons why to continue the war, so then we will give up, you know, our arms. There will be, of course, a process where we're going to negotiate how we're going to deploy
right.
arms, you know, under what circumstances and what conditions. But the main point was that whatever who won the elections was going to be the one that will impose the conditions for any kind of political settlement. So the Salvadoran government have not been able to gain the support of the people. That have been recognized by even colonels or generals of the armed forces when they said our war is 10% military and 90% political, and when they see that they have no possibility to gain people's support to go against guerrilla fighters, right? So that is clear. And the second is that that in the FMLN platform, the proposals that we have presented to address the economic crisis, to address the freedom of expression, or civil rights, you know, has been very clear, and a wide variety of sectors have endorsed those proposals. Last year, for example, the Catholic Church called for a national debate where about 65 popular organizations, grassroots organizations, came together into a big room, and they agreed that the reasons of the causes of the war were misery, repression, and lack of freedom. You know, exactly the kind of conclusions that we have been presented in their proposal. So that is the problem of negotiations, you
right.
know, who really have concrete proposals. We have presented ours. Salvadoran government hasn't presented any, except to say the guerrillas should lay down their arms and incorporate themselves into democratic process. What democratic process? About freedom of expression. What they will do is the state of siege, you know, as a way to control the freedom of organization, the freedom of assembly, the freedom of for demonstration. All those they will be introduced in the legislative assembly. So officially, the armed forces and the security apparatus of the state will come to any office of any grassroots organization and to kidnap people at the time they want and to keep them in prison at the, all the time they want. And exactly what they're doing, you know, with all sectors of the Salvadoran grassroots movement. And so that will increase polarization. Mm-hmm. And polarization is not on the benefit of anybody. Mm-hmm. Polarization and repression, genocide, is a suicide for ARENA, because we at the FMLN are better organized, are more politically developed, with more recognition in the international community, with concrete proposals that have been supported by most of the active political sectors in our society. And militarily, the question has been that if the FMLN can win this war, not if the Salvadoran government can win the war over the FMLN, because even generals at the Pentagon have said that the Salvadoran army won't be able to win this war over the forces of the FMLN.
There's been a lot of urban unrest too, hasn't there? Labor, leaders, students, working people.
Well, to add also to the economic situation that I think is very important to characterize, the coffee crop, for example, on which more than half the peasant population depends from picking coffee, the income provides them, that's their sole income for the rest of the year. This has been the worst coffee crop in the last 30 years, so there's famine in the countryside. So we say there is an inevitable social explosion on the way in El Salvador. Unemployment is 90% in the countryside, 60% in the cities. So on top of that, this is directly, there is a growing mass popular movement that people who are on the threshold of desperation have organized themselves, only received from the government repression, only received from the military, the death squads who are killing them, who are torturing them. Now these people already have entered a phase of insurrection. They are staging attacks on military units, they're conducting rioting sometimes in San Salvador. The situation is chaotic.
They started unleashing the power of the state against different groups, peasant groups, religious groups that were helping the homeless and the displaced, labor unions, etc. So in other words, repression has begun again from the ARENA party. Could you give your analysis of what you think they are doing through utilizing repression and beginning again with death squads and torture?
As I said before, ARENA, mm-hmm. by nature, mm-hmm. is a repressive party.
Right.
ARENA as a party came from grassroots organizations that were organized by the National Guard, like Orden, for example, that during the 70s was responsible for massacres in the countryside. ARENA comes from those grassroots organizations that, for example, forced Robert White, the former ambassador, to leave the country.
Right.
So this is the nature of ARENA, you know, a real anti-communist fanatic, you know, organization.
They had claimed that they had eliminated the death squads and torture, and they were now a more respectable democratic force. But the actions on April the 19th would seem to contradict that. Why do you think ARENA risked getting a bad image through carrying out these repressive measures? What is your analysis of the motivations or reasons in mm-hmm. the current situation for them to carry out such policies?
Well, I think that ARENA wants to preserve the economic aid that comes from Washington. And they understand that the Bush administration will have problems if ARENA behave as a death squad, right. as a death squad organization. They understood that they came to power to endorse officially, constitutionally, all the massacres and killings that the Salvadoran armed forces and the security forces will carry it out against the popular movement. ARENA has not become officially a government, and it's already repressing.
Right. right?
The problem of the death squads, I think, is a tricky problem, you know, because death squads, in fact, are not organizations linked to the ARENA party. Death squads are special units of the Salvadoran Armed Forces that are used to repress, to avoid political problems to the institution, to the armed forces as an institution.
Right.
What ARENA will do is, as I said before, to legitimize, to endorse officially those kind of repressive measures. Then ARENA, controlling the Legislative Assembly, the Supreme Court, the Executive Branch, and of course, you know, all these, how do you say, languages, official languages or constitutional measures that they will implement will give green light to all these brutal army officers that they, what they want is just to, you know, stop any opposition movement.
Can you give us some statistics or a feel for the repression that's been going on there? They've had the death squads, although I think it's funny in some newspapers, even in the Associated Press, occasionally you'll see the words alleged death squads, as if nobody's really been able to prove that they are. But there's been horrible repression going on. How many people have suffered because of this?
Well, let me say, we agree with the word alleged death squad.
Oh, really?
Because there is no difference between the military of El Salvador and the so-called death squad. You see, the concept of death squad was a very beautiful and effective concept used for misinformation. You get military men who change their uniforms or civilian clothes and conduct all-out repression, and in that way you don't blame the government, Mr. Duarte, and the State Department, and the United States Treasury, because the United States is financing the military of El Salvador, and the military is conducting these atrocities, although they just take off their uniform. So we have to combat this notion that there are these squads that are not related to the government, that are not related to the armed forces. That's a very important point. The other point, of course, with the election of ARENA in March 19 of last year to the legislature, with their control of the legislature, and with the growing mass popular movement, and because of the advances of the FMLN and the deterioration of the military situation, the repression has escalated incredibly. Already more than 1,256 people have been reported killed since last year. There have been countless people who get arrested, tortured, and then released. You cannot measure the repression in the countryside simply because neither the church, nor American Watch, not any of the observers of human rights have access to the countryside. The countryside is sealed by the military. And let me also add the situation.
Well, I understand that it's been just an enormous bloodbath in the countryside because there have just been indiscriminate bombings and strafings of the people there.
That continues. You see, as the war advances and as they fail to contain the FMLN, because the FMLN has really developed their ability to merge and become one with the people and move from the countryside into the cities. So also attacks on the countryside consist, as a matter of fact, the mayors, there's a whole system of municipalities in the countryside that are controlled by the military and are part of a paramilitary network. The U.S. press always presents these mayors as civilians who are elected in elections, like the mayor of New York City or the mayor of Dallas, and do never present that this is an all-out real war. Now, these mayors have been presenting all the information, the intelligence, to both the army and the air force to come and bomb villages and to come and detain and torture people for allegedly participating or supporting with the FMLN. So in response, the FMLN has captured these mayors and warned them, stop doing that. They continue doing that. So there have been 8 mayors who have been applied the maximum penalty to them to try to stop that. As the military loses ground in the countryside, then all of a sudden, more than half the municipalities, the mayors have resigned simply because they were part of the military network, and with the military losing ground, they realize that they cannot survive in that, so they resign their post, and the FMLN permits them to reside there. So,
how many people have been killed since, say, 1980, since the Republicans?
Well, most observers believe that 70,000 people have been killed. And let me also add, the press always presents, they say, in the civil war in El Salvador, which has cost 70,000 lives, that and right away they add increased violence from both the right and the left. So the implication is that the left has killed 35,000 and the right has killed 35,000. That's very beautiful. Again, very neat. These people should be given the Pulitzer Prize for misinformation. From 1980 to 1984, over 45,000 people were assassinated in cold blood, and this is all documented, by the military of El Salvador and by their own death squads, to put it that way, including the Archbishop of the country, those four North American nuns, including the president of the university, and 17 journalists, over 14 priests. It's incredible. The press has no memory. It's very important to argue that with the election of Mr. Duarte in 84, they say situations better. The situation got infinitely better. Not only 50 people were being killed a month and not 900 a month. They have committed genocide. They had decapitated, they thought, the entire revolutionary movement, and they could create conditions for democracy. But the revolutionary movement was not decapitated and went into the countryside and became the FMLN. And it has, the past popular movement now has reemerged in the cities because Mr. Duarte was neither willing nor able to carry out any true socio-economic reforms, control the military, displace the oligarchy from the traditional power, from owning the land. Mr. Duarte's role was, after 4 years, it's obvious now, to present the facade, the Christian Democratic, that's the name of his party, facade, to justify increasing, escalating the war. That went after before he was elected, El Salvador was receiving something like $50-60 million of United States aid. After in 85, after his election, El Salvador was receiving $580 million a year in United States aid.
And I understand that this was the pivotal thing, that the rebels were just about to win militarily in 1980-1981, and only with this enormous increase in pumping military support to the government that they were able to turn back the military challenge of the rebels of that time. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
In combination, by 84, it was called a low-intensity war approach by the Pentagon. It's a euphemism, of course. A Pentagon spokesman put it bluntly. He said it means total war at the grassroots level, but we don't commit U.S. troops. We finance, we do the training, we send about 200 advisors, but the killing and dying is done by those people down there. That is precisely what has failed now, see? If the United States were to escalate their involvement in El Salvador, they're going to have to send their own troops, because the local troops already in El Salvador, the Salvadoran military, are in crisis. The FMLN inflicted over 7,956 casualties last year alone on the military, and now this is unfortunately the casualties are on the troops, on people who are conscripted, drafted violently, and middle-level officers. So this level of attrition has already created a very serious demoralization of the Salvadoran military. Unfortunately, the higher sectors of the military, who are like aristocrats, the lieutenants, the colonels, etc., have not been as affected. So they are the ones who want to continue the war, but there's going to come a time now, a point, where this army is going to simply collapse, precisely because of also the social differences within the military. And the FMLN also is a very smart entity. For example, they accuse the FMLN of placing mines on the roads, which is incorrect. Mines, homemade mines, are used by the FMLN to seal access to the zones of control in the countryside. Controlled by the FMLN. Usually access that, you know, there are only a few paths to which you can climb some mountains, and the entire population knows that whenever there is an invasion, those paths are going to be mined, and they don't walk around there. The entire population around there are relatives of the FMLN. The local people. Actually, the FMLN places signs saying, danger, minefield, and the next sign 20 yards behind says officers first, as a means of promoting precisely this dissatisfaction and divisions between officers. But the point is that the government, the press, have been conducting a campaign in the United States that these mines are maiming and killing the civilian population, and always trying to present the FMLN as bad, as terrorists, as the government army and the right. So I use this opportunity also to emphasize that this is not the case. The FMLN uses mines, but always warns the population, and even, as I told you, put signs to tell.
A lot of people don't know who the FMLN is. All they know there are guerrillas, they're insurgents, they're told that they're communists and by the U.S. government. Can you describe the FNLN? It's actually a front of a wide variety and of people and quite a wide range of opinions and interests, isn't it?
Yes, the FNLN comes from organizations of radicalized students, agrarian workers, trade unionists, formed around the 1970s in El Salvador. By 1985, different organizations came together under the umbrella of the FMLN. You might find in the leadership, basically people who might call themselves socialists. Some of them might call themselves Marxist-Leninist. That you might find also radicalized Christians, all kinds of, I would say, above all, however, that by 1980, they had allied. They made a political alliance with the FDR, for example, which is a democratic socialist political formation. They don't believe in armed struggle, although they make an alliance with the FMLN at that time. The position of Dr. Ungo, I think, is exemplary for the rest of Latin America and for the United States. Dr. Ungo is a person who argues that you cannot be democratic and at the same time be anti-communist. Because by being anti-communist, you are rejecting normally what constitutes the left of the country, and this includes hundreds of thousands of people. People who have been radicalized, who are seeking other alternatives, that we have to find a consensus, a center-left consensus.
Like in Nicaragua, the Sandinistas, in the government there, you have two or three parties to the left of the Sandinistas,
sure.
Two or three to the right of the Sandinistas.
This is a case of pluralism. I think what joins us is not allegiance to the Soviet Union, as people here very simplistically like to begin. What joins us is not the radical transformation of our society into a socialist state, because all of us know that there's simply no room in a country that is completely dependent on an international market and in which the United States can invade any time. You are not going to create and invite that invasion. What joins us is changing the system in which the oligarchy owns 1% of the country, owns about 60% of the land, changing the system in which the military are the absolute arbiters of power, the need to democratize our society, the need to open up new markets to make the people produce better and have a share on what they produce. I think our philosophy overall is socialist, but in the sense of with a strong emphasis on democratic socialism that also respects sectors of private enterprise, that sees the need to coexist with an international market that is capitalist and coexists with the United States. And that also, the importance of the FMLN proposal is, again, we have grown so much, we are so powerful, at the same time we have become so sophisticated as to recognize that we can bring about a change in our society through peaceful means if we all of us get together and begin to reform the system. The proposal of the FMLN called for channeling the entire conflict and defining it in electoral terms. That is why Washington could not refuse that proposal. All of these 9 years they've been saying these guys are communists, they should not be accepted, they should be defeated, they should be killed in El Salvador because they're opposed to elections. All of a sudden there we come and say, okay, let's have elections. And we will respect that, but just carry out the necessary reforms in an electoral system, cease the repression, permit us to organize, give us a chance, we will take that and we will win, because we are in the position of winning now through elections or through the present process of war.
You've used the term oligarchy. Can you tell me about that? As I understand, like in so many countries of the world, including the United States, they're dominated economically and generally and politically by a few families. And I always hear about the 14 families of El Salvador.
Well, the oligarchy is an old Greek term that means the few who are rich, in a loose translation, and is a political science term used to define the very few families who control societies like those of El Salvador. Yes, they're known as the 14 families. I always like to say they get offended when they say the 14 families. They say, no, we're 21. They're the people who own the land. The land produces basically three things: cash crops, coffee, cotton, sugar. As you all know, 91 of these crops is raised to feed the population. If you feed the population coffee, cotton, sugar, they get sick and die. They're meant to be sold in the international market, be transformed for cash. The people who own the land own the foreign trade apparatus, the firms that export, and they also own the banks. You have this high concentration of wealth, the entire means of production in the hands of a few families. That's what has produced the revolution in El Salvador.
Now, do they also control the military, like in some countries?
So from 1932 to 19 to the present, there had been an alliance, obviously, between the military and the oligarchy. They sustain each other. The military actually had drawn the country from 1932 to 1980 and interrupted every president of El Salvador was a military man, because such a scandalous concentration of wealth can only be maintained through force. That's the sad reality. Now, after 1980, the United States argued that the introduction of Mr. Duarte in Salvadoran politics, of his Christian Democratic Party, was going to put an end to that old model. But the sad reality has proven that the military were the ones receiving most of the U.S. aid, since the aid is for a counterinsurgency project, and those in charge of implementing the counterinsurgency project are the military. Mm-hmm. So they had become strengthened. At the same time, Mr. Duarte never carried out any real reforms and never displaced economically the oligarchy from the traditional control of the land, and neither ever exerted any influence on the military. In 1980, out of 10 families in the countryside, 3 had access to running water. Today, only 1 out of 10 families has access to running water. And you can see the implications for hygiene, for infant mortality of this reality. In 1980, maybe there were 3 doctors for every 8 or 9,000 people in El Salvador. Some of them in the countryside. Today, there are only about 1 doctor for every 12,000 people. And all of them are in San Salvador, in the capital city. So this gross deterioration of human conditions in the countryside, despite $4.5 billion sent by the United States in aid, there is something grossly terrifying here, that all of that money was used for war. The government, neither the United States, ever carried out anything to change conditions in the country, and that's why we are where we are today. The people are on the verge of insurrection. The FMLN has advanced, has taken root, deeply rooted itself in the socio-economic political reasons that had created the conflict, and the United States has that option. Either they really seek negotiations, genuine negotiations, or they're going to have to escalate militarily. There is no other option. This is why this is a major crisis, and forcing the administration to define themselves even before they are organized in Washington. They're not yet. They don't have a policy for the region.
I saw a documentary a couple years or 3 ago, which somebody was interviewing a member of the oligarchy. They were in a nice, big, ritzy restaurant, and they were having a big steak dinner. And the person was asking them about the political situation in El Salvador, and they was asking this person, a couple of people from the oligarchy, said, "Well, which of the parties do you support?" They named off 3 or 4 different parties. And the person from the oligarchy said, "Well, my dear, it makes no difference to us. They're all our parties. We created them all." What about now? Is the situation, did they also, is Arena, the right-wing party, is that their party now, or is Duarte, are they both their party?
Well, what passes for democracy or democratic system in El Salvador is made up of fundamentally 2 parties. The official party, the Christian Democrats of Mr. Duarte, which is now finished really as a political party, is divided, has the 4 years, is completely discredited, and has already had 4 years of corruption, the worst corruption ever in Salvador and history. The problem with them is that they antagonized the oligarchy, really. They were created by United States. The United States channeled over $2 million for the election of Mr. Duarte in 1984. Who denounced this in the U.S. Congress? Nobody else but Jesse Helms. In that, for once, we agreed 100% on our issue.
Jesse Helms is a big backer of Arena.
He's a big backer of Arena, and he was protesting. It was the intervention of the United States in Salvadoran affairs in support of a party that really has no social base, and that was being inserted and forced on the oligarchy. You see, Arena, the Christian Democrats really had a program of reforms that were to be done at the expense of Arena. That's why they antagonized him. To describe Arena in political terms, you have to be an octopus. You have to have more than one right hand, because they're ultra, ultra right hand. So they call the Christian Democrats, they call them watermelons. They say green, because that's their color, but in the outside, and red in the inside. They call Mr. Duarte communist. Similar to Mr. Jesse Helms, too, who calls anybody who defends democracy a communist. So the reality, therefore, is that ARENA indeed have become the organic political expression of the oligarchy, of the super rich, of the traditional owners of the land. The Christian Democrats had become the principal vehicle of insertion, so to speak, of the United States into the political spectrum of El Salvador. With the demise of the Christian Democrats, U.S. influence diminishes, stands to reason, and within that very reduced and rigged system, the importance of ARENA increases.
What do you think the possibilities of a regional settlement to the problems in El Salvador are? We've heard about the Arias plan that was at least supposed to deal with the Contra war against Nicaragua, and they really haven't intervened as decisively on the El Salvador situation, have they? But would this be a possibility?
By principle, we believe that that's the best option.
Mm-hmm.
Because we believe in the right of for self-determination. We think that the political conditions in El Salvador and the atmosphere that has developed, you know, because of all these ongoing movements of opposition, proposals coming, and all the concerns that everybody has about El Salvador, we believe that there are conditions for a new initiative from the region that will help to prevent more tensions in the region. We believe that the last agreements of the five presidents in regards to the problem of the Contras, we believe is viable. The only problem we see is that the Bush administration, instead of helping that, has complicated the whole process by accepting giving more aid to the Contras. So we believe that for El Salvador there has to be a new initiative that doesn't exist at this time. You cannot apply, you know, the same formulas to resolve the problem of Nicaragua to the problem in El Salvador, because there is no comparison. The only comparison is the United States intervention. Mm-hmm. As we have been saying, you know, the equivalent to the Contras in El Salvador is not us. Is the Salvadoran government, because both are sons of the Bush of the Reagan administration.
What we are proposing has been reduced to a simple implementation of the principle of Esquipulas, or the so-called Arias plan. You remember when that took place last year in Central America? It was mainly applied to Nicaragua.
Right.
But what has happened in El Salvador is that the FMLN and the FDR have developed so much power that now within the country they can make a proposal and can guarantee that it actually take place. One, the reduction of military forces. That's what they also present in the Arias plan. From the present 56,000 the Salvadoran military claims, we actually know they only have about 36,000 in the field. They have suffered such an attrition. Reduction to the level of before 1980 to 12,000. Crucial reduction of the military forces. Two, the dismantling of all the security forces. See, the FMLN in the last meeting in Mexico City presented to the political parties of El Salvador that proposal. He said, we will be willing to lay down our arms and we will participate in the political process of the country, participate in elections, etc., if the military reduces their size to the size in 1980, if the security forces are all converted into one police force and the jurisdiction or the control of that police force is taken away from the military and given to the Interior Ministry, becomes more like a civilian police, like that of Costa Rica.
But can you trust that?
this is the proposal. However, we have a saying in El Salvador that it's very easy to militarize a civilian, but it's practically impossible to civilize the military. We know that. But we are making a proposal. This is and the last component of the proposal was, and this is like a distillation or concretization of how we can participate in elections. If a process of prosecution, a trial and prosecution begins on the murders of Monsignor Romero, of the four nuns, of the massacres in Las Hojas, where over 70 indigenous people were assassinated by the military, the massacres in the Sumpul River. Not a single officer yet has been prosecuted and sent to jail for these massacres. So the proposal of the FMLN is very clear but very serious. It says we can create conditions for democracy only if, again, the de-escalation of the militarization of our society, the civilization of the military, of the, especially the security forces from which most of the killings take place, and the foundation of a system of justice. Can that take place? I think so. If you get the United States interested really in promoting a process of seeking a political solution, in promoting a process of negotiation, if you get the international community interested in sending observers, at the same time, I said, from within, we also are powerful enough to guarantee that those changes begin to take place. Any type of opening in El Salvador will be accompanied by an all-out explosion of organizing and participation of the people. This is even manifest. The ARENA promised, after the proposal of the FMLN, they rejected it outright, but then they changed their minds when they saw that every political party and the State Department were interested. And they actually proposed that the FMLN go for 2 days and meet with the political parties and the assembly in San Salvador to explain their plan. And the FMLN accepted right away, but the army told ARENA, look, you can meet in Mexico, not here. You know why? Because if those guys come from the hills, there will be 100 or 150,000 people here with banners showing how much support they have. So they cannot permit that type of, any type of opening will be followed by rapid participation of people. And that's why the proposal really has a future. Now or 2 months from now, the people are losing fear. In El Salvador, people do not participate politically because of their repression. People do not really disappear. We used to say people appear cut up. And that's what the military does. They kill people as a means of freezing with terror people and keep them from participating. As the situation develops more and more, as the FMLN is stronger, as we take the initiative also politically, setting up the agenda, the political agenda of the country, people lose their fear and begin to join in and begin to, it's like a tide that cannot be turned.
It seems to me that there is kind of an irony here. If the U.S. Cuts its aid to the government and particularly to the military in El Salvador, and if it cuts its military aid to the Contras, you're going to lose a lot of your sources of military supplies. I understand that the Contras sell you arms, and also the Salvadoran military sell you arms.
Well, that's correct. True? The principal source of weapons, despite allegations that indeed the revolution is direct. The direct supply line comes all the way from Moscow. The principal source of weapons is, number one, the Salvadoran military. I mean, we have captured from the military a great deal of weaponry. We actually buy ammunition from the high command of the Salvadoran military, which is extremely corrupt. And in the last 6 to 8 months, you have an army that has lost the war, doesn't have a war to fight in Honduras. It's equipped up to their teeth with U.S. equipment. Equipment that was supplied to them and aid that was given to them illegally, as you know, because of the Iran-Contra. We're talking about the Contras. Actually, one of the most important weapons they have been selling the FMLN is red-eye missiles.
Oh, you can shoot down the helicopters.
And that represents a major shift in the balance of forces in El Salvador. They have not been used yet. But the moment helicopters begin to fall like flies, it will certainly be a major change. Mm-hmm.
I think the reason why we have been able to get in touch with new political forces in Latin America, because, you know, two members of our general command did a tour over Latin America in October last year. In the United States, it was reported as a setback, no? Because they said that all presidents were saying to us that we should participate in elections. And in fact, at the end, we presented a proposal to participate in elections. I think it is because all these countries, governments or political tendencies, you know, in Latin America have been reflecting on the problem of the external debt, on the problem of being so dependent on the United States, and they look and they're seeking an alternative. And we, in one way, represent one option, which is that democratic forces, pluralistic forces, because the FMLN, even though it's carrying out the armed struggle, it's social base. the support that we received, that we enjoyed, comes from a variety of sectors, no? So then all these political forces in Latin America see the problem of El Salvador as an example of what may happen, you know, if the United States intervene directly and suddenly destroy that process. That will be a setback for all those democracies that are emerging in Latin America, or for all those democratic movements that exist in Peru, in Venezuela, in Uruguay, in whenever place in Latin America that are looking for an alternative. That's why we said that the resolution of the problem in Central America is very key and very vital for the United States' interest in Latin America. It's vital on the right sense, right? Because if the United States believe that that the best interest is to destroy the democratic and revolutionary processes there, you know, what they're going to face is a very strong opposition with Latin America. If the United States supports, you know, these emerging democracies in Central America, wherever they come from, in no matter what kind of forms it will take, you know, but if the United States supports that, it will give options to all different Latin American countries to resolve the problem of dependency, to resolve the problem of economic crisis, to resolve the problem of social discontent, right? And that's exactly what we are suggesting to the United States government, that they should find a more constructive policy towards the problems of Latin America. Don't see those problems as a way of communist expansionism, because that's an ideological point of view and close possibilities for understandings.
Let's assume that you win the elections. You still have the oligarchy in power there. You still have this enormous maldistribution of wealth and income and owning of the land. What can you? It seems to me that the oligarchy is going to have to be dismantled before any true economic and political democracy can come to the country.
Well, I think what people don't understand in this country is how much already we have advanced our society to creating a political consensus around a common platform that is an alternative to the U.S. project and an alternative, a direct negation of the platform of the oligarchy. The consensus already being built in El Salvador is growing. As this grows, for example, consensus over negotiations and participation of the fronts in the negotiations, consensus towards carrying out a true agrarian reform, a series of reforms that do affect the structural causes of the conflict, which is malnutrition, distribution of wealth, etc. And the issue of rescuing the national sovereignty. You see, more and more, hundreds of thousands of people already are being mobilized over this platform. So both the oligarchy and the armed forces are more and more politically isolated. The more isolated they become, the weaker they become. And there's going to come a time, in conjunction with the military activity of the FMLN, in which those sectors will be forced to seek some sort of an accommodation. We have to leave the doors open for that. We don't want to be in a situation. It will be ideal if through negotiations we solve this war in El Salvador, because we will be creating a new, as I said, political consensus, a center-left type of coalition that will also be open to sectors of even of the oligarchy of ARENA who are willing to participate in the reconstruction of the country.
It will be in the interest of everybody. Mm. Because, listen, even if there is a negotiation, even the oligarchy will be beneficiated, because they will be able to preserve political identity. You know, they will be able to continue and go further in the whole process of development of our country. If there is a war confrontation and suddenly a negotiation is forced because we are just about to take power, then the oligarchy will have problems, because then it will be ours, the one that will be, you know, suggesting what concrete steps should be taken. We believe that, you know, the private sector had the right to invest it has the right to get profits from that investment. We don't believe that just because they own more resources than others will gives them the right to impose their political conceptions or their philosophical conceptions. In those things we don't believe. We can argue with them, we can debate with them, but if they just think that using the armed forces will give them the right to impose their political conceptions, we don't believe that is true and that that is beneficial for the development of our country.
We cannot afford to lose the middle class of the country. We cannot afford to even create a new society or seize power under conditions in which the United States can use that as an excuse to create another contra force. And we cannot create a new society antagonizing the regional countries. We must coexist with the governments of Costa Rica, Mr. Arias, for example, with the governments of Guatemala. We must have trade. We need. So we have, in many respects, moderated our revolutionary model, become very practical about the need of relating with our Latin American neighbors, and continue to leave, not only leave the door open for a political solution, we are the only ones setting out initiatives. And those initiatives are there to be taken up when both the sectors of the military and the armed force and the oligarchy realize that it will be a lot cheaper and easier for them to, the price of peace will be a lot cheaper than the price of war. If the war continues, they're going to lose everything.
But I also want to add something. I think that if there are possibilities for negotiations in different regions of the world, it is because the world has changed, not only because the Soviet Union has taken an initiative, but that it is because the world is changing. Everybody realizes that we're coming closer to an economic destructional crisis, you know, and everybody has to look for their own ways to protect your own country. So then that gives possibility for political solutions. I think the United States have been forced, you know, to retreat from some places, but it has not retreated in the right directions, because in Afghanistan, the United States still supports, you know, the guerrilla fighters there, even though there is an observation from the world about the possible destruction of Afghanistan. But what about Central America? You know, the Bush administration haven't given any positive incentive, you know, to resolve the problem in that region. So we believe that it is just up to the U.S. people, you know, to ask their government to change their policy. We think that the best interest for the United States in Central America is to have peace and social stability instead of war. And at this time, the United States is suggesting just war.
So it's really ARENA that's the monolithic party in El Salvador that's using the armed forces to try to create military solutions to all the problems, where it sounds like your group is a more democratic, pluralistic organization that will allow a variety of different forces to negotiate in the society as to the direction of policy.
Yes, because that's the nature of our struggle. We won't be able, you know, to keep our forces fighting if we don't have the support of the people. And it's hard to get the support of the people, to convince the people that they should risk their lives, you know, for something. It is hard. It is not easy. We don't have, you know, all these mechanisms to carry it out of psychological warfare on the people. The only thing we have is the moral reasons, the political reasons why we need to struggle, and that we can represent the interests of all these people. They understood that. You know, we have been able to establish a good, friendly relationship, supportive relationship between the civilian populations in the zones of control of the FMLN, and even in the zones of expansion. Sense of expansion when our forces are mobilizing constantly, no, to carry out our military campaigns. People there, you know, respect us. People there do not inform the armed forces about our moves. People there give us food, give us clothes, you know, give us information. And it is because we do not come to them and impose to them that they should support us. No, we come and live with them. And these people realize that we are the same kind of people, right? That our way to see the problems of El Salvador, you know, it's similar to theirs, right? That our ideas about how we should administrate the economy, why do we believe that the peasants should have access to productive land, you know, all these things, people understand it, right? But what happened? If a sergeant comes to a town and talks to a peasant, you know what the sergeant says is, don't believe in the lies of the terrorists. They are offering you the impossible, that the land one day will be yours. That is not possible. Hmm. You know, they will never be able to get the support of the people.
Gustavo, to conclude our discussion today, what would your message be to the American people? What would you like to tell the American people in conclusion about your country and about the U.S. involvement in El Salvador?
Well, I think that the United States people should be clear that there are limited options for the U.S. government in El Salvador. One is to go ahead and support a death squad government in El Salvador, and that means that the United States will be providing the means to people who wants to kill as many Salvadorans as possible in order for them to preserve power. And the other option is the United States to support an alternative policy that will be able to resolve the problem of El Salvador, that will be giving us, as Salvadorans, a chance to show that we can and that we are the ones that should resolve our problems. There are concrete alternatives there, and the United States government should consider it. There is no concrete sign on the part of the U.S. legislations or policymakers about what they're going to do with El Salvador. Just the idea that the Arena government is legitimate because it comes from an election that they consider democratic elections. And if the U.S. administration continue with that kind of policy, they will be responsible for what's the tensions that El Salvador will create in the region.
Well, thank you for spending this time with us and explaining this very complex situation, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. I think all of us, both the people in El Salvador and the people of the United States, need a lot of luck. This is a this is a time when there's a chance of humanizing U.S. policy and humanizing the people of this country. I think you have been dehumanized, especially the way you look at the rest of the world, the way you look at El Salvador. Realizing that you can constructively bring about a political change and an economic change, and instead of sending money for war, send money for reconstruction, for development, that will do you a lot of good.
Thank you.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. We'd like to thank Brian Lynch, who set up our set and was our director, and also Austin Community Television, ACTV. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Bye.